Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasts.
You're going to have a lot of pain points in life. But what if we start thinking of our pain points as new opportunities? Welcome back. This is True Crime Connections, and I am Tiffany, your host. This week, we are talking about neurodivergence, genetic coding, and the cycles of abuse. Today, my guest, Victoria Danielle, is here to share her story. Hi, Victoria. Thank you so much for being here.
Tiffany, super excited to be connecting with you.
Thank you. I don't know where you would like to begin in your journey. Sounds like you have had one hell of a journey.
Well, girl, it's been a journey. That is for sure.
Yeah, wherever you feel comfortable, where you would like to jump in, feel at home. This is your floor.
Perfect. So I guess I could start with a little bit of backstory about me. As Tiffany said, she referred to me as Victoria Danielle. My biological name, my given name, is actually Victoria Benson. But as part of my reinvention post-trauma, post-abuse, I've actually just made a very recent decision to start going by my first and middle name. It's just kind of a way to like make separation and separate my identity from my abusers. So I wanted to start there and say, just kind of get that out there, because I know that if people start searching or trying to find me under Victoria Danielle, they're not going to see much, because that's a very new development. So, gosh, where to start? It's so much. So there's so much. I'll share a little bit about my background. I'll try not to get too deep into it, because, like I said, I got a deep, chaotic, wild story. But my experience with trauma and abuse stems from birth. So I was born into a really chaotic and dysfunctional family. I had a mentally ill mother, a father who I believe is also mentally ill. My mother was an addict. My father went through phases with addiction. Neither one of them were fully present or consistent in my life. And it was a really violent environment that I grew up in. So my mother, she had lots of aggressive tendencies. My father had lots of aggressive tendencies. There was a lot of domestic violence. My mother had several different boyfriends who, I would witness beat her. There was one time that I'll remember my mom and one of her ex-husbands, they were arguing, and they were in the garage, and I remember him picking up a can of like a gas can, and just throwing it all over her, and then backing her into the corner and flicking a lighter into her and like me as like a 7-8-year-old like witnessing that. And so, that's just one of many, many examples. Like my experiences were not people just fighting just to fight. My experiences were people did not know when to stop fighting. And there were so many times that I was so afraid that I was going to witness someone's death. And so, that kind of abuse, that kind of trauma obviously affects a person.
Growing, to say the least.
Yeah. Yeah. It was not a healthy environment, for sure. Like I said, I did not grow up with my parents present. My grandparents are the ones who primarily raised me. My mother pretty much couch surfed, or occasionally she had boyfriends that she stayed with for periods of time. But she was frequently in and out of my grandparents' house. So I saw her fairly often, but she did not really hold like the mother role. And she wasn't like the consistent caretaker. So the relationship with her was pretty troubled. Now, my father, on the other hand, really interesting dynamic there. We lived on the same road. He lived about a minute down the street from me my entire childhood. And he was a firefighter, so very small rural town. And I remember, you know, as a kid, like watching his car go by like multiple times a week, you know, all the time. And like wondering when he was going to stop and see me. Like, when was he going to stop and pick me up? And, you know, looking back, that was another form of abuse that I don't think is talked about enough, which is when kids are utilized as pawns and, you know, parents are pitted against each other. And then there's this whole entire like subconscious manipulation thing going on, and it breeds a lot of shame. So me as a kid, feeling like I was always in between a lot of adults that had a lot of problems, feeling like I would be, you know, in trouble or get offend someone if I showed too much attention or got close with certain family members. That kind of trauma is unique in the way that, like, it just always made me feel like I had to be responsible and show up for everyone. Like, I could never reject anyone for my own purposes or my own needs. And I think that people understand that obviously big T trauma and, you know, having, you know, those big domestic violence things or the main dysfunctional chaotic, you know, the typical experiences that you would think about that lead people into domestic abusive relationships or marriages as adults. I think everyone's kind of familiar with that and how that plays out. But I think it's less talked about how those more subtle dynamics, like, you know, the animosity between parents and a child being in the middle, or, you know, custody battles and children being brought into it. There's a lot of shame bred out of that and a lot of people pleasing, because kids love their families no matter how dysfunctional or chaotic they are. Like, they don't see the negative, the wrong that badly. And when they feel that they're being put in a position to where they have to choose someone, there's a wrong choice. Like, there is a wrong choice at the end of the day in someone's eyes. And, you know, that forces the kid into this position of not being able to be honest with how they truly feel about a dynamic or a relationship or a connection with someone and who they want to spend their time with, because they're made to feel like their job is to please or, you know, not reject their primary parent or whatever the case may be. So I think a lot of that kind of led into my future relationship. My now ex-husband, that was another abusive dynamic where I felt that I never had the ability or the right to reject someone, or to walk away from someone, or to not choose someone, because it was always that shame-based programming that my family kind of put into me of, you know, I was kind of this like caretaker. I was a very parentified child. You know, I was everyone's go-to peacemaker. The oldest daughter. So, of course, if everyone knows the oldest daughter dynamic. So I think that just being in such a parentified role as a child, and then also having that shame from, you know, being forced to essentially value adults' feelings or other people's feelings or wants or needs more than my own, led me down the exact same path of, you know, experiencing abuse, even though I knew better. So I can say that the witnessing physical abuse and physical violence, that's very easy to pinpoint. You never have any doubts or questions about what physical abuse is. You know exactly what that looks like. And I grew up with a lot of that. But the more subtle subconscious emotional abuse, financial abuse, verbal abuse, all of those things I also grew up with, but those were mild in my opinion, you know, my experience compared to the near death violence. So many of the, you know, smaller complex traumas that, you know, lend into forming your belief systems the way that your families interact with you, you know, that becomes how your brain is wired. That becomes your normal. And you grow up and you seek that out because that is, again, normal. Anything outside that that deviates from that is, wait a minute, I don't resonate. I don't like this person. I don't relate to them at all. And so my ex-husband and I met when we were 15 in high school. And so the whole entire high school sweetheart situation. And, you know, back to that point of that I had just made about how you seek that out, like anyone who doesn't relate to your experience just isn't, it's hard to relate to when you're young or when you're in your early adulthood and you haven't processed through these things. So we bonded over our similar chaotic, dysfunctional home lives. And I'm sure you can imagine where that went.
Yep.
Yeah. The trauma bond was very real. The cycles of abuse and gaslighting and all of those things were very real. But, you know, it started at a young age. And even though I was always had this gut feeling in my stomach that just something wasn't quite right about it, even though I couldn't really pinpoint, you know, I didn't have the language or the understanding of emotional abuse dynamics or verbal abuse dynamics or the control dynamics. I didn't really have the conceptual ability to be able to make sense of those things, but I felt it in my body that something was wrong, that it wasn't right, that it wasn't okay. I wasn't happy. But again, I was never taught that it was okay to value my own feelings. Everyone else is bigger than mine, more important than mine. Ignoring my feelings was how I kept myself safe and in a position to, you know, be the person that doesn't get left behind. You know, that's how I made myself valuable to other people in my family and in my childhood. And so, you know, even though it was very toxic, and I would agree now, looking back, abusive at a very early on state. I stayed with him for 10 years.
Mm.
Married him.
It's a long time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it was. And I thought that it was just me. You know, like I had, like I said, my special interests, psychology, mental health, trauma, all of those things. Those were all things that I very much so studied. And I knew that because of my trauma, I had all of these experiences that were going to make being in a close relationship difficult for me. And it was going to make me more sensitive or more sensitive to rejection or more sensitive to tone or more sensitive to language. And so all of these abuse tactics for the longest time, I thought were only triggering my trauma instead of it being actual abuse. So a lot of the time I'm like, oh, this is triggering this past situation of abuse. And I'm like, now looking back, I'm like, no, it was actual abuse. Like, it wasn't triggering a past wound. It was a new wound. And, you know, so it's things like that were difficult to work through.
I believe you probably also had some abandonment issues because your parents were pretty much absent. Mm-hmm. And you kind of wanted to latch on to somebody who showed you the attention, showed you what you wanted to see, even though it wasn't always the right things they were showing you, right. He was still showing up.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in the early stages of an abusive relationship, you know, everyone will experience that initial honeymoon stage. You know, there's lots of love bombing, lots of those things. And, you know, the moment of abuse, whatever that escalation may be, it is over really quickly. And the reconnection phase is usually pretty quick too. And right back to that love bombing and gaslighting. And so, you know, I'm sure, you know, it's pretty interesting how our brains kind of get addicted to that up and down, you know, that the dopamine rush of abuse,
right?
Serotonin rush of violence, you know, all of those things are like straight drugs in our brain. Like our bodies become to the point where we're basically craving it. And, you know, a lot of times that's why people will subconsciously stay in those situations or go back to those situations. They leave and they feel this crazy dopamine and serotonin crash because there's nothing in their environment that's activating their nervous system. And, you know, we stay activated and dysregulated and in a state of just absolute chaos when we're in these abusive dynamics. And then we think that that's our normal the longer that we're in this abusive dynamic. Even when it's you're not actively experiencing abuse, you always have that activated system. You're always on guard. So when you're not on guard, you're like, ooh, everything feels really strange. And it drops people right to it because they want their brains are creating that dopamine. And subconsciously, that's where they're getting their dopamine. So that's where their brain's telling them to go.
The brain is such an amazing feature. Like it's amazing. It really is, because you can lie to yourself. You can actually believe your own lies because you're trying to protect yourself. And then once you try to relearn what you learned, like, no, this is not okay. It's a really hard balance to kind of juggle between, because a part of you is still like, but no, I mean, they really do love me. And the other part's like, honey, that's not love.
Right.
It's hard.
And, you know, something that I experienced a lot of with my ex-husband was this narrative that his anger, his frustration, his jealousy, his control, all of those things were born. You know, if I didn't love you so much, I wouldn't get so angry. If I didn't love you, I wouldn't want the best for you. If I didn't love you so much, you know, X, Y, Z. And it's really confusing. Like you said, the brain is an incredible thing. And we can choose to believe those things because it keeps us safe in that moment. You know, during that time when there was so much chaos and I knew that I think subconsciously I knew that I wouldn't have it. I didn't have the ability to mentally and emotionally, manage on my own. I think I knew that each time I left, I was going to be back. And it took 7 attempts before I was actually gone.
I believe 7 is like that magic number.
Statistic. Yes, it is the statistic. And that blew my mind. I actually had to sit down afterwards and like count it up when I saw that statistic. I was like, I wonder how many times it has been. But, you know, the brain's a powerful thing. And, each time I left and came back, I had new beliefs about myself that I didn't have prior. I had new guilt. I had new shame. I had this feeling that I had done the wrong thing. I was the one that was weak or abusive, or I was the one that was, you know, the typical gaslighting and narcissistic abuse situation. As an autistic person who really, like, I have an uncomfortable amount of self-awareness. It wasn't always true self-awareness, but I was always trying to, like, look at myself and figure out where am I going wrong in this dynamic? What am I doing here? Because I was taught from a very young age that it's my responsibility to ensure other people are happy, safe, comfortable, and, you know, there's not chaos going on. And so, you know, I took a lot of accountability, like radical accountability, for a lot of the problems and the abuse dynamic that were not my problems. but I'll say that it's at the end of the day, I think I can be grateful that I took that approach, because that's how I figured out that they weren't all my problems. You know, he convinced me that it was me. You're the one that's, you know, causing all the issues. You're crazy. You're just like,
oh, God.
Oh, I love that.
That one pisses me off so bad.
Favorite. Yes, you're crazy. Love that. And I finally just got to the point where I just started agreeing. I'm like, yeah, do you see like the laundry, like the dish sink full of, you know, medications I have to take for my brain every day? Yeah, like, yeah, fine, I'm crazy. If that's what you think, and you think that's going to insult me at this point, fine, sure, I'll take it. You're still acting like an asshole. You're still being abusive regardless of whether I'm crazy or not. Anyways, so after that convincing, I actually took it very seriously and went to therapy. And I was 100% willing to work on myself. By that point, I had a baby with him. We had a life together. We had bought a house at a young age, baby at a really young age, basically like rushed through the early adulthood experience because I don't know. I think it was painful for us to stay still or patient because there had to be chaos or else something was wrong. So when we're, I'm not sure why we thought that adding a baby was the right kind of chaos, but we did that.
I think, honestly, I mean, you might have done all that so young because, in a sense, you guys wanted to keep each other. You didn't want the other one to go anywhere. So it's like, okay.
It was a lot of convincing on his part. Like, I remember we had broken up several times, like, right after high school. When I was 16, my mother had committed suicide. So I was going through a lot of depression about that. I was just dealing with a lot of my own feelings and trying to work through myself, figure myself out. So we had broken up several times. The last time we had broken up before I got pregnant with my daughter was right after our engagement. We'd been engaged for, like, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 months. And all of a sudden, you know, we're young. All of a sudden, he's got this Folgers coffee tin and he writes baby fun on it and puts it in, like, our top cap. And, like, once he's, like, really pushing for, like, a baby and a family and, like, let's do this. Like, we can do this. And, you know, I was at first, like, super, like, uncomfortable and weirded out by it. And so I kind of, like, pulled back. I felt like we were immediately settling. I felt like I was immediately settling. So a couple more months went by and we split. We broke off the engagement. It was a whole, of course, crazy, entire emotional, chaotic thing. He had never been abusive, like physically abusive at that point. But I always had fears that he would become that way. And so we split for several months and then got back together. I think it was probably 4 or 5 months in. And within weeks, he was back on the baby thing. And of course, we're in that love bombing phase. We're like, floating on dopamine and serotonin high. I was. I don't know about him. And
oh yeah, he was too.
instead of making a decision, it was just, you know, lack of prevention. And next thing I know, I'm having a baby. I had just moved back in with my grandparents. I was living in my childhood bedroom. And within like 6 months, we had moved into a house, got vehicles. Like, I was ready to go. Like, I was ready to level up for this kid. I'd started a job at a staffing agency. It was a really good job. And then I got promoted to like a branch manager position and then started working for another staffing agency. So, like, went from serving tables to working a, you know, a 9-to-5 desk job, making pretty decent money. And I thought that, you know, we were going to be good. Things are going to be fine. All of the toxicity from before was us being immature. We were young. We had to go through it. You know, we just had to grow up. And I say we because I had my fair share of toxic tendencies too. I didn't come out of my abusive, chaotic, dysfunctional childhood unscathed. I definitely had some toxic codependency going on, trying to control other people's emotions, people pleasing, all of those things. And not a lot of that's not genuine. You know, people pleasing at the end of the day is a manipulation tactic. And the person that's being people pleased is aware of that. And it never feels genuine and always feels comfortable. So those were some things that I was aware of that was toxic in myself. And of course, his verbal abuse and emotional abuse, he had a bit of a temper problem. But getting back together, I was, you know, over the moon, things were going to be fine. You know, it seemed like we were growing up, we were maturing. Within a year, we had bought a house. A year after that, we had sold that house and bought another house and had moved about an hour away from our hometown and then moved back. And when we moved back, that was like the turning point, the tipping point for him. You know, there were several years where things seemed really good, really decent, stable. But moving back to our hometown and I think being around that environment, being around those triggers, being around his family who were addicts, I don't know what clicked or snapped in his mind, but he just became a different person. Started drinking very heavily. When he would drink, he would get really aggressive. He was not a happy drunk. He was a mean drunk. Had several run-ins with the police and drinking and whatnot. There were several times that I had left the house because I was uncomfortable when he was drinking and he started being aggressive or trying to do intimidation tactics. And so, you know, it kind of just continued escalating from there. He would get angry and his reactions would be, you know, just over the top, violent reaction. He would throw things, slam things, punch walls, slam doors, call names, like screaming at the top of his lungs. And it was always terrible. And I remember just feeling so just small through all of it. Not even like too small to even do anything about it. Too small to say anything. Too small to tell anyone. Too small to go anywhere. Just like this teeny tiny little person just stuck. And so that dynamic continued for several more years until it hit its peak in 2023 last year, which was actually a year ago this week. Would have been the first time that he actually became physically abusive. And the first time it happened, he did not hit me. He didn't slap me. He didn't punch me. He strangled. He strangled me. I do not even know how to explain that kind of fear. I watched my grandfather strangle my mother when I was very young. And I still to this day remember, you know, the vein popping out of her forehead, the bulging of her eyes, how purple her face was. Like, I can remember the straining. Like, I can see that very clearly. And so that experience triggered me so badly that I essentially just, like, I think I just dissociated. I think I just completely cut myself off emotionally because I knew I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't have any way to leave. I owned everything, but he didn't have a job. He had quit his job, so he didn't have any money. I was a support person, and that's a scary position to be in. You know, it's a really scary position to be in when you're physically or financially relying on your abuser, but also I think it's just as scary when your abuser is relying on you, because that moment you try to leave, they've got nothing. Nothing. So within, you know, weeks, he lost everything he'd ever had. So that situation was terrifying. I remember it very clearly. He had strangled me. That happened two more times. And then again, the very final thing that happened was back in September, he had another one of his big meltdowns, screaming that he hated me. He had started threatening divorce a lot, started saying that he didn't love me anymore, which was fine. Honestly, like, I was just so detached that I was waiting on him to go. Like, I was waiting on him to be the one to make the move. The more I pulled back and withdrew and stopped feeding him with that last supply of, you know, any kind of attention, I stopped feeding into all of the arguments and the chaos. And so that's when he started threatening to leave. And the last day, he told me that he was going. He wanted a divorce. There was a whole entire argument. I remember him screaming and yelling. I remember being on the couch working. So I work from home. And him, like, coming over and screaming over me on the couch, punching the couch, like, every bit of force he had, like, right next to my head. I remember him going back and forth from our living room to our bedroom, like, just slinging clothes, trying to grab things that he'd leave with. And I never even stood up off the couch until he went into our kitchen, and I heard something fly across from our kitchen and hit our living room wall. And then I heard something pull out of the knife wall, like the sound of, like, a knife being pulled out, like a metal scrape. And that was the moment. That was the moment that I was like, he's about to kill me. He's going to do it. He's going to do it right here, right now. And I was still sitting on the couch in our living room. I immediately picked up my phone, called 911, put it in my back pocket, and stood up to go see what the hell he was doing. I was scared as hell. And he had this knife, and he was coming toward me with it. And he had the knife in one hand, and with the other hand, he was punching the wall as he was walking. And with every punch, he was screaming, I fucking hate you. I fucking hate you. At the top of his lungs. Like, scary man voice. Very scary man voice. And at that moment, I pulled my phone out of my pocket, and I clicked the speaker button, 911 was already on the call, so they heard a little bit of it. And she was saying, ma'am, what's the address? What's the address of your emergency? And he stopped, and it looked like he was a deer in headlights. And he started, like, backing up, and he still had the knife in his hand, and he looked like he was in pain. Like, it looked like a desperate man in a desperate situation. And I don't know if any of your viewers, any listeners on here have ever seen the eyes of a very desperate man who is about to do some scary shit. I will never forget the look on his face, the look in his eyes when he realized the cops were coming and he just had a knife in his hand and was about to kill me. Because it was almost like he was contemplating, do I do it now or do I go to jail? Do I do it and get it over with, or am I going to jail? And it's like he sat there. There was just like a few milliseconds, and I went walking toward him, and I was like, you have to give me the knife. I took the knife from him. It's a 12-inch butcher knife. He was just kind of like frozen, I guess, like in indecision. And I was moving super slowly, and I was like, you have to give me the knife. And he didn't even move. I took the knife from his hand. And the next thing I know, as soon as it's from his hand, he's running out of our door, slams the door, gets in his car, slings gravel back and out of the driveway. And I run to our back door, lock it, run to our front door, lock it. I'm still on the phone with 911 at this point. And so I'm watching out the window. I'm telling them that he's leaving. Next thing I know, he's putting the car in reverse. He's coming back up the driveway, slinging gravel, knowing that the cops are on their way, knowing that they're on their way. And when I saw him pulling back up, I was like, ma'am, he's coming to kill me right now. Y'all, please send them fast. Please hurry. And so the two main doors to get in were locked. And I went through our bedroom and out to our back porch. And I can see through that glass door. I left the bedroom door open so I could see when he was coming and had enough. I would have to run. So I stayed on the back porch because I didn't know where he was in the house. I didn't know if he was outside. I didn't know if he was corner. I wanted to be able to see, and I wanted to have multiple routes to go. So whether he came around the back to the back porch and was in our yard, I could go inside that door, lock it. If he came in through another route, I could go through our backyard to somewhere else. I don't know where I was going. But I could hear him at first, like, banging on the front door from the back of our house, beating it, punching it, screaming. And then it gets quiet for a little bit, for, like, I don't know, maybe a minute. And I'm just really intently listening. I'm still on the phone with 911. And the next thing I know, he's busting through our bedroom door. He had a window. He had gone through a window. And I took off running, barefoot. Just took off running. Didn't have a direction. I just took off running. Ended up in a neighbor's yard and still on the phone with 911. And he came off the back porch and followed me. And then when I was far enough in front of the neighbor's house, he stopped. So we were about maybe 30 feet away from each other. And he was screaming and crying, just absolute hysterical, pure desperation mode. And then the cops pulled in. And as soon as the cops pulled in, you know, he goes completely calm. You know, pulls the entire narcissistic, you know, abuser act of, you know, he didn't do anything wrong, he's so calm. And I'm still hysterical because my husband almost just murdered me. So he's calm, he's fine, he's communicating with them. I can't even formulate words. And so they don't do anything.
Oh, stop it.
They think it's just an argument. He doesn't walk away in cuffs. I call my best friend to pick me up, and I stay gone for 2 weeks. That entire 2 weeks, he refuses to leave the house. He harasses me on the phone. He blows up my phone with text messages. He threatens to take our kids from school and leave with them. Just absolute nonsense. I had to get a restraining order. And 3 days after the restraining order was issued and he was forced to leave my house, forced to leave the house, he showed back up around 10 p.m. at night, had parked his car down the street, and walked in the dark to come to my house. And I still don't know what his purpose was for coming there, but I had a neighbor who actually ended up being his family, who had told me, you know, if he shows up, you call me first. I can get there faster than the cops can. Let me know, I come up and help, and then you call the cops. So I told him to leave through the door, and he was being very adamant no. So I called the neighbor, and I was like, I need your help. So the neighbor came up, and next thing I know, my ex-husband is full on assaulting this man. Like, they're fist fighting on my front porch. They're still fist fighting when the cops pull in. And this is an older dude. Like, he's probably in his 50s. And my ex was in his mid-20s, late-20s. So, and my ex is a pretty stocky dude. Like, he's strong. He doesn't really know his own strength. And, yeah, so the cops pull in. And, you know, the cops coming out, like, with a flashlight screaming, "Stop swinging, stop swinging." I don't remember what it was that he was screaming, but he was telling them to stop fighting. They were still fighting, the cops in the driveway and everything. And so he went to jail in handcuffs that night. And I have not heard from him since. Since that night, I have not seen him. I have not heard from him. I stayed in our hometown where we lived in the same house for several more months. I was willing to cooperate with, you know, some sort of co-parenting if he got anger management classes and went through therapy. Well, I found out soon after that he was on drugs, suspecting meth, but I don't have any confirmation of what actual drugs. But so that obviously escalated all of the abusive and violent behavior, all of the aggression. So yeah, it ended that day after 10 years of absolute hell. And continued to feel like hell until I just ripped the band-aid and packed my kids up and moved to a new city a few hours away. Changed my phone number. He didn't know where I am. He didn't know how to get in contact with me. If he tried to, I would, again, just have him arrested for breaking the restraining order. But it's one of, I'm not very far out of this, to kind of say the least. I'm not far out of this. And when I say that the amount of power I feel now compared to how I felt then is indescribable. You know, it's only been about 6 months, and I don't even resonate with the version of me that was in that marriage. I don't resonate with the version of me I was 3 months ago. Because I feel that when you're in that growth mindset and you're willing and ready to heal, once you start removing barriers, it's like that growth just happens. And that was my final barrier. That abusive relationship was my final barrier. And it's like once it was gone, now I'm not going to sit here and say that it was easy. It was not easy. I have spent so many nights screaming, crying. I sat alone in my house for months, did not leave my house. Me and my children, we went to school and back. That was it, because I was terrified of running into him in public. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat. I lost like 70 pounds, and I get complimented on my weight loss all the time now. And they're like, "Oh, you look so good. What did you do?" And I'm like, "Abuse, you know, that tends to happen to you." I like to make dark jokes. It makes other people uncomfortable, but if it makes them uncomfortable, then I know they're not.
I get it. Sometimes a breakup can be the best diet.
Honestly, like, I lost so much weight just from pure self-neglect, and, you know, the weight loss was over the year of, you know, abuse, but I feel like I just, you know, it seems as if that relationship, that dynamic was the barrier to me being able to grow past all of my own childhood traumas, my own adverse background experiences. You know, I've always had the drive to want to do differently. And he always convinced me that he had that drive too. So, you know, one of my big, you know, values is the fact that I want to break these generational cycles. Like, I do not want to repeat the same mistakes that I watched other people repeat. And, you know, that's, you already know how that's going to turn out. Like, we already know how that's going to go. I want something different. I want something I haven't experienced or witnessed. And, you know, he had convinced me at a young age that he was the same way. He wanted to break those cycles. He wanted to do those things, wanted a different life. And I realize now that a lot of people will say that, but in his case, I think it was really more so a manipulation tactic. And maybe he did truly want to. Maybe he was really just too deep in his own demons. But I feel that when somebody really does want to you know, make changes within themselves, nothing's going to stop.
That becomes your new dopamine. Mm-hmm. I swear, like, when you decide that that's no longer serving you, you want to grow, you want to become better, that fills all that up, because now you're feeding off of your growth, and oh, that's so much more healthier.
Oh my God, I know. Like, I don't know if you're a Taylor Swift listener. Are you a Taylor Swift listener?
I am. I do. I'm a Swiftie. What can I say?
Okay, so her album that dropped today, The Tortured Poets Department, I was listening to that before we joined this morning, and I was getting ready. And there are several songs on there. There's this one called The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived. And it had me in tears. It had me in absolute tears, in like the most complex of ways. It was like the strangest mixture of gratitude and grief, but also one of those, like, you know, you watch those coming of age movies when, like, you know, the girl's closing her trunk, she's moving, she takes off driving into the distance, and it's like she's starting her new life. It's, you know, one of those like really emotional scenes. That's how I felt, you know, just like sitting here and just kind of reflecting and thinking on like just the last, I'd say the last 2 years of my life, but more so the last 6 months. I can't even describe the excitement that I feel when I accomplish something that I used to think would be impossible. Sitting here speaking on this podcast, if you had told me 6 months ago I was going to be on a podcast, I would have been like, you're absolutely nuts. Like, you're, no, there's no way. I don't speak at all. And it took a lot for me to like start learning how to use my voice. I started making like video journals just as an after practice of vocalizing my thoughts and feelings, because I pretty much stayed mute for the longest time. You know, you can't really vocalize your thoughts and feelings when you're in an abusive dynamic. There are consequences to that. So I started doing that. And then I started making like little silly TikTok videos just to kind of process. And, you know, the more I made those things, the more I realized like, there's nothing that like nothing bad's happening. Like, wow, look, no one is busting my door down to tell me I'm a terrible person or to tell me I'm weird or I'm annoying. Like, look at that. I can speak. And sometimes I do have some valuable things to say. And, you know, it started this whole development of, you know, just, I would say my radical reinvention. That's what I like to coin this little era of my life is my radical reinvention. I would say, you know, like I said, it started about 2 years ago, but I would say it's reaching its peak, and it has been for the last 6 months. And today I just had a moment as I was listening to that song of gratitude when I realized like that chapter of my life is coming to a very clean end. The house I owned, I will close on the sale in 2 weeks. From that, I'm able to take care of a lot of the things that were left over and messy in the divorce. I was able to move to a new city. I've only lived in my apartment for about 3 months, but I'm getting ready to move out of this apartment into a house. I just launched my coaching and consulting business. By trade, I'm a corporate HR person, but I'm now a corporate dropout. I'm pursuing creative pursuits. So I'm launching coaching and consulting. I've got a photography business. I have a media and branding business, all of these things I've done for years, either freelance or work for a company. And, you know, this entire experience gave me like the belief in myself that like, I can go do that too. Like I can go do this on my own. I just survived some of the most intense trauma. If I can do that, I can do any hard thing. And so I've been doing that. I've been here for a few months now, and, you know, I've gained a few photography clients, corporate photography clients. I've had lots of networking opportunities. I've met some people in Atlanta that are going to be podcasts. I've started, you know, collecting a lot of my writing through the years. So I've always been into poetry or just journaling. And I've started pulling together lots of pieces of that I've, you know, had since I was 14, 15. And eventually I think I'm going to compile it into just some sort of book, you know, probably for a good ADHD brain that's not going to sit down and read a whole book. It will probably be something like, you know, just snippets of poetry, names of songs, pictures that, like, quotes that I find inspiring, just a random compilation of my healing journey that other people might find interesting. And then
I love it.
Yeah. So therapy will be the biggest. Obviously, I'm going to shout to all of your listeners, please go to therapy. There's nothing wrong with going to therapy. Please do it. And I would personally recommend a psychotherapist, especially if you've got complex trauma or if you're neurodivergent in any way. Cognitive behavioral therapy is incredible, but psychotherapy, that is where I really was able to dig into not only the things I was experiencing, but the reasons underneath that I was allowing myself to experience those things. So huge one there.
Isn't that mind-blowing when you can sit back and be like, holy shit, this is why I do the things that I do. This is why I've put up with the things that I put up with. This is why I act the way I act. It's crazy. It is absolutely mind-blowing. Because same with me, you know, there was 14 years of dealing with abuse in two different relationships. And you really do have to reinvent yourself, because if not, you're just going to stay exactly where they wanted you. And that's not good for anybody.
Yeah. I like to say that I pulled myself apart at the threads, picked myself apart at the threads, and then wove a new person. And every time I feel like I've like leveled up, like I've reached a new level, I have, I call myself, I'm currently on VIX 7.0. So VIX 6.0 was when I moved to Atlanta. VIX 7.0 is now happening currently, where I'm actually launching everything and, like, you know, pursuing the sharing of the story, the storytelling on all of these creative side businesses.
Do you find yourself bored at work while eating your lunch?
Do you watch the clock waiting for work to be over?
As you're sitting in meetings, do you find your boss's voice sounding like a howling banshee?
Then don't wait another minute. Tune into the Paranormal Peeps podcast.
We are ready to entertain you.
Vic 5.0, she had it rough. She had a rough time, but she was the end of an era. She was the turning of an age. So I can't wait to see Vic 8.0 or Vic 9.0, because I know, like, we got to keep going. Like, it doesn't stop at 7. So I'm super just thrilled to continue, like, the growth and, you know, the experience of picking yourself apart, I don't think ever really stops, at least in my experience, it hasn't. But nope. You learn to be, and instead of picking yourself apart, you learn to just be, it becomes just sort of an awareness instead of an act. Because I feel like I used to put a lot of intention behind, like, why do I do the things I do? Let me dig into this behavior. Let me dig into this reason. Why is this upsetting me? And now I just kind of experience my emotions and I let them pass. I acknowledge them. I spend some time with them. If I'm feeling triggered by something, you know, I might really lean into that. But for the most part, you know, just the letting it pass phase is the most important. Not every emotion requires an action. And I think that's where a lot of people, that's where a lot of people mess up. You know, everyone has these big emotional experiences. We're human. That's what we are, you know, we are designed to experience emotion. Like, that is what sets us apart from the rest of the animal kingdom, our ability to experience emotion and connection and our sensory experiences. And so, like, that's what makes your human existence, you know, fruitful and inspiring and meaningful, is all of these deep emotional experiences. And when they happen, a lot of people think they need to do something about it. And that's the thing, is your emotions, you're processing through this trauma. Whatever you're feeling, it doesn't require you to do anything. It just requires you to acknowledge it. Maybe add a name to it in your mind. You start feeling anxious when you're triggered by something. You can acknowledge, wow, I'm feeling really anxious right now. And then you just sit through that anxiety. You don't have to go problem solve. Do something that makes you feel better. Do something that boosts up some dopamine or serotonin or calms your body down. You should see your emotions as clues. They're usually prescriptive. They're not to-do lists. They're not action items. And I like to reinforce that to everyone, because for me, for the longest time, every emotion I experienced was, an action item.
I love that. I really do. I love that. It's so true. So true.
It removes you from yourself. And, you know, I think that the more I leaned into those negative emotions and those negative feelings, I truly believe that my capacity to feel the positive feelings grew with it. So it's like the more I got comfortable with my dark feelings, the more grateful and present I could be with those lighter feelings. And coming out of dissociation has been quite an experience. Like once you're no longer in that constant fight or flight stage, you know, you just experience the world differently, like in a sensory way. I've noticed that like sounds are different. I'm experiencing lights differently. You know, just my entire human experience and existence is, it's almost starting to feel like it's me and not just the symptom of trauma. I used to feel like I was just a walking trauma response. And now I feel like I'm a whole intact walking individual badass who grew through some shit and pulled herself out of the mud. And so,
yeah, you are.
Yes.
I love that. You are. You are a badass. And you need, I am so proud of you. Like, seriously.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It's been a journey, but I think that I'm just continuously humble. And, you know, being proud of yourself is an important part of it. As an abuse survivor, abuse victim, whatever label people want to give themselves, I know everyone has different, varying levels of comfort with those things. But I feel like regardless of that, just the acknowledgement of being in an abusive relationship is hard as shit. That's like one of the hardest things you can do. That like requires so much strength and endurance and resilience. Like if you can be in an abusive relationship and survive your way out of it, then you can do pretty much anything because that is the hardest shit. Starting your business has nothing on that abusive relationship. Going to the gym has nothing on that abusive relationship. You know, making sure you eat well, getting enough sleep, taking care of things that need to be taken care of. Nothing feels as difficult as being in that relationship does. Nothing.
Absolutely.
Remove
that. Because it attacks you from like so many different areas.
It does. It really does. And it lasts. It sticks until, you know, until you make that choice to go and start unlearning it. And you know, our brain is constantly forming connections and it's forming beliefs and it's constantly looking for confirmation that what it believes is true. And if you believe that, you know, you deserve abuse subconsciously or that you're not worthy of love or that everything is unsafe, then your brain is always going to allow you to stay in situations like that. So it is really important, I think, to start digging in, unraveling, do your therapy, remove those barriers, and then see what you're really capable of. I had no clue. I always felt like I had this like energy or drive in me that I could do so much if only I could stop spinning my wheels. Well, I wasn't spinning my wheels. I was being held back. It wasn't me.
Right. Big difference.
Dragged back. Yeah, it's a big difference.
Big difference. Yeah, I mean, once you can identify where you need to go and start on that road, don't ever look back. Keep driving because it's only going to lead to greatness. Where you are now, it's going to lead to you staying stuck exactly where you are, and you will never grow. You will literally get what you settled for.
I think something else that I'm having to work through now, as an after effect of all of that, is some trust in myself that the other shoe's not going to drop. So that's been a huge experience. So like as much pride as I have in all of my growth and as much humility I have with all of it, I still have this deep fear that, oh no, like I'm going to experience something and my psyche is going to break or like, it's just going to fall apart. Everything's going to fall apart. I'm going to lose my coping skills. I'm going to regress in some way. I'm going to hit burnout and not be able to function as a human. And, you know, those thoughts still nag at me. And I have to remember to counter those because, yeah, anything could happen. I could get in my car and get on the highway tomorrow and get in a car crash and die. Like if I want to go down the route of thinking about all the bad things that could happen now that I have good things in my life, I'm removing myself from experiencing the good things. You know, the more I worry about the other shoe dropping, the more I waste my time and energy on that, the more I'm removing myself from the experience of the shoe not dropping.
It's like right.
You put yourself through it twice. So I've really been working on undoing those thoughts and, you know, learning to trust my own path, my own intuition, and my own gut about things. and being able to make decisions and be decisive about what I feel is best for me, without that decision paralysis and, you know, rumination of how is this going to affect? What are the consequences? How will I be hurt by this? Now I don't have to think in those ways. It's like everything I do has this underlying foundation of like self-love and growth underneath it. So any attempt I make, any decision I make, I already know I'm looking at it through those lenses. And it's like everything I am doing at this point, you know, I tie back to self-love in some way. If I can't prove that it shows that I love myself, I'm not making that decision.
There you go. You got to give yourself grace too, because I mean, this is going to be lifelong. There's going to be triggers that you didn't even know were there. There's going to be things that you are going to have to constantly relearn or yeah. learn for the first time. So you got to give yourself that. You can't expect, especially in your case, come on, girl, like it's been 6 months. Like, you know, you can't be like, oh, I should be perfect. Yeah, no, that's just not reality. It's not going to happen.
And, you know, something that you mentioned about, you know, having to learn is grace for yourself. That's been a big one I've had to learn. And, you know, once I separated from this marriage and I was sitting in the wreckage of my own life, everything around me, all I could think for the longest time was, how did I let this happen? How did I let this happen? And I was blaming myself for, you know, making the decisions and being in this environment and staying too long. And all of these things where I was just taking full accountability for what happened to me. And I had to counter that because, you know, like I had to learn some grace. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to work through it. Like I got to a point where I was like, I have no choice but to work through this in a way that does not instill more shame and guilt and lower my self-worth, because I'm already as low as it can get. It's already as low as it can get. I just started leaning into like delusional positivity. Like I'm not kidding. When I say delusional positivity, like something bad happens, some inconvenience happens. Guess what? I'm countering that with, it was some kind of divine intervention from the universe to make sure this thing didn't happen later. Like I'm always countering, and like, I'm just, it's, and it really does. It really has like began to rewire my brain. Cause you know, everybody has life shit that happens. You know, your life stressors happen. Every time one of those comes up, I'm able to be like, okay, A, what's the lesson here? What can I learn from this about myself? And B, this is totally just protecting me from something else in the future that was going to be bad. So let's just believe that. And it works.
I like it.
In a state of like I said, delusional positivity. It's different from toxic positivity. We know that it's delusional. Toxic positivity is delusional positivity. They just don't know it's delusional.
I'm gonna start using that. It's just my delusional positivity.
Yeah, I have lots of little words like that. So delusional positivity is one that I love to say. Gritted teeth optimism is one that I love to say. Because I feel like that was me for like the last like 4 or 5 months. I'm just like gritting my teeth and smiling, and I'm like, it's gonna be, it's all gonna work out. There's no other option. There is no other option. So I'm just gonna grit my teeth through it. And instead of coming at this with there's no other option, I'm coming at this with I get the opportunity to level my life up because now I have a blank slate.
Right.
And that was my gritted teeth optimism stance for a hot minute. But yeah, I got lots of weird little quirky phrases that sprinkle in everything.
I love it. I love quirky. I'm quirky.
But like, if we can't be boring. At the end of the day, if you don't have quirks, then come on, find some. Find someone to pick up.
Find some.
Go to the quirks. Do something, because like, we need a little bit of entertainment. This is 2024. The world's in flames. Like, come on, y'all. Let's just be weird. Let's be full weird.
For real. I mean, it's the only way we're going to get through it.
Seeking weird reality and authentic people. Like, people want the weird.
You have found your people.
That's how I know when I have found my people, is when I can be like, all right, how weird can I get? I'm constantly like judging, like I'm gauging, like what's the level of weirdness that's appropriate in this environment with this person? And if it is too low, then you're not my person. Because
I love it.
I don't know. I might break out into song or dance. I might draw a few SpongeBob references. I might like say something that reminds me of a song line. And the next thing you know, I got to sprinkle that song line in. I get a little bit chaotic and quirky, but that's okay because, hey, at least I'm not depressed and miserable and abused anymore. Like that's where I'm at. I'm like, you know what? I don't even care if people think I'm weird because people used to think I was miserable.
Right. Absolutely. I'm the same way. Like my mind is like a freaking jukebox. I can think of songs. I'm just like, once. Right. Dancing out of nowhere. People are like, what the hell's going on?
Do you have ADHD? It's like, I'm curious. Do you have ADHD?
I do.
I knew it. I knew it. As soon as you said that, I was like, yeah. Part of the fam. We got it. We got the same brain, the spicy brain.
Yep, we got it. And I don't mind it. You know, I don't. I embrace it. Like,
once I was able to pinpoint it, I didn't get diagnosed until last year. I'm going to say that was a huge part of my, you know, recognition era was my dual diagnosis of ADHD and autism at 25 years old. And holy shit, when I say, like, not only I learned how to stop working against my brain and like working against the way I operate and instead of working with it. And now, instead of just feeling like I've got like dysfunctional chaos going on with people that are up there driving the boat, now it's like I learned how to work with it. Like, I now can bask in my creative ideas. Like, I follow them. I know that they're not going anywhere. Like, it's just been really interesting to kind of study myself. Like, I feel like it helped me create this separation of me, who I am as a person, versus my brain as an organ. And it's like, I feel like that was pretty monumental, is like that separation of you versus, you know, the brain who's just doing its job is so valuable. Because like I had to keep reminding myself when I was going back through triggered states and like searching and ruminating and all these things, your brain's job is not to make you happy. It's not to make you content. It's not to bring you joy. It's to keep you safe and alive. That's it. Like, it's to give you information about your environment that is going to keep you safe and alive. From the moment you're born, that's all it's collecting information about. How do we stay safe? How do we stay alive? It doesn't give a shit about whether or not you're happy. So understanding that your brain's just an organ with a job, like you don't have to, you yourself are a different, there's an essence there that's different, that's underneath all of that. And, you know, the more that you let your brain run the show, it will, because it's going to constantly seek confirmation of every bad thing that's ever happened to you and the truth that those beliefs are real or reality. And so, you know, we're no more the thoughts in our brains than we are the air pumping through our lungs or the blood pumping through our veins. Like, it's just an organ. It's just an organ at the end of the day. It contains information. We determine how we utilize that information. There's an essence underneath that. So, yeah, like understanding that separation was a big part of my post-abuse healing too. And honestly, being in the abuse also, understanding how my ADHD kind of played into it, how there were so many things that I would miss because I would get in ADHD conversations can be rough sometimes, especially ADHD arguments can be rough, because you can lose track so easily because your brain is just processing so fast. And when you're in an argument with someone who is actively gaslighting and manipulating you, you're following their train of thought, not yours. You've already lost yours. And before you know it, you're confused. And like, that's very typical for any kind of abusive dynamic. But when you've got ADHD, it's like, wait a minute. Like, you are so much more confused because you walk away and you're like, I don't even know what the fuck just happened. Like, you're still trying to process, and the only thing you're taking away from it is the abuse that happened. And you don't even remember what exactly it was you went to, you know, be upset about. Now you're just upset about being abused for being upset. That was the ADHD thing is interesting, how ADHD and autism kind of play into abuse dynamics.
For sure. Oh, for sure. Because it changes your brain. It changes your ways of thinking. So we think differently than other people. and that's okay.
And for me, I've found, you know, that ADHD and autism makes me, I don't think so much now because I've got that self-awareness, but there's this level of naivety that I had. I tend to believe what people say, not so much anymore. I've learned some lessons, but I tend to take things at face value if people appear to be off. So someone that's lying directly to my face, if they look and feel authentic and their story checks out, like, I might not have any like qualms about that. I might be really easy to manipulate. And it might be really easy to, you know, like over a period of time, morph this entirely different like dynamic because of that manipulation. And the pattern recognition, being able to understand things. And also, you know, people tend to say that autistic people, you know, have a hard time with empathy. I do not. I'm like hyper empathetic. And so the empathy for my ex-husband paired with the pattern recognition of mental illness and abuse dynamics and trauma outcomes and trauma responses, it's like I could not view him as all bad because I knew that it was mostly his trauma driving the boat. But then I continued to have to counter myself eventually and be like, you know what? That doesn't matter. Like all abusers are probably traumatized at the end of the day. It doesn't mean that they're not abusive. And, you know, there was this version of me that couldn't stop seeing him as like this wounded little boy that was just angry at the world because he was so unloved. And that kept me stuck for a while mentally and emotionally because I had so much responsibility with that codependency stuff I had going on. But with the empathy, the autism and the empathy, you know, I don't think it's a normal level of empathy. Like, I feel like I genuinely, physically, full on feel what the people are in my environment are feeling. And like, I think about things from their perspective and I'm always trying to like understand and like pick apart people's brains and their thoughts and try to make sense of, you know, why they are the way they are. And I could understand how each of my ex-husband's behaviors formed because I knew so much about his history and his background. So it was so hard for me to remove myself, like to separate those things. It's like I wanted to see him as the version of himself that he was when he wasn't traumatized and triggered without taking into consideration that the triggering behavior and the trauma responses were still him at the end of the day. It was still, he's still driving the boat here. And, you know, we all say our triggers are our responsibility. They are. But
can't let it define you.
It can't. Yeah. It can't like become actually who you are. And I feel like right. That is one of those things, like, my ex-husband, God, please edit that out. I think my ex-husband's triggers became who he was. And his trauma responses and the way that he coped with those triggers became who he was. For example, the alcohol and the drug use, you know, obviously those things come with experiencing trauma or having mental illness. You know, you're just seeking a way to be more comfortable in your existence. And it's not healthy either way at the end of the day.
Absolutely not. Nope. Got to deal with it a different way. All you're doing is masking.
Yeah.
So what is going to be the name of your podcast?
So it's called Radical Regards. So that is kind of this whole radical concept is very true to me. And so I think everything is kind of themed around you know, like radical transformation. So the podcast will host lots of different guests on that will come on that are going to share their personal background, maybe their trauma stories, maybe we'll have some trauma dump it. I don't know. It'll be a little bit lighthearted. A variety of people. Like there's a very niche topic that I'm talking about on my podcast. So I want all kinds of people. You don't have to be a mental health expert. You don't have to be a life coach or a personal development expert. I want the, you know, VP of HR at some company to come and tell me about how he grew up in a super abusive dynamic and then paid his way through college and now is, you know, leading this department. You know, I want to hear from people who are real, that have real stories, and I want to see how they have actually transformed their lives. And beyond that, I have lots of advice and lots of lessons to share. You know, I've drawn lots of conclusions from my own experiences. And granted, I'm not a psychologist. I don't have, you know, a psychology degree. I did go to school for industrial organizational psychology, but that is a whole different ballpark. Oh. So, you know, like the credibility that I bring is purely in my own life experiences over the course of 26 years and tons of research, and tons of, you know, conversations with other people and lots of therapy. So I'm not, you know, the goal is not to teach people or, you know, therapize people via podcast, but the goal is just to share some inspiration, some good stories. And, you know, I want to hear from people that are maybe a little bit unconventional. Your artists, you know, your people that grew up and started down a corporate path and then they were like, forget that. I want to do something different. You know, I want to hear from the rebels, the weirdos, the change makers, the generational cycle breakers. So it'll be really interesting. I've got lots of marketing going out for it over the next few weeks. We're lining up guests for the first few months, and I'm going to be talking about it on several other shows, including this one. So I'm really excited about launching it, and I think that it'll be really valuable for the audiences that are kind of looking to get out of their funk and level the fuck up.
Absolutely. I mean, that's pretty much what my podcast is. I talk to people of all different kinds of backgrounds. We talk about what you've been through. We talk about where you are now. What did you learn? What worked for you? What didn't? Because there is so much shit out there. We got to be in the know. We got to learn and we got to grow.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I feel like that is what we're here for. If you're not learning, if you're not growing, you're staying still, you're staying stagnant.
That's right. Can't do that.
Being a person in the world requires maintenance.
Yes. Well, if somebody wanted to get a hold of you, what would be the best way? Do you have a website or?
I do have a website. So my website is radicalvictoria.net. And that also has links to my four businesses. So if you are looking for any other kind of, you know, I've got a coaching and consulting business where I work with business like companies. My professional background was in, like I said, corporate HR, but precisely a little bit more specifically in like people development and learning and organizational development, diversity and inclusion. I led some programs at my old corporate job. I led a corporate diversity and inclusion council. So there's lots of business related things that I bring to the table. And what's really, I think, interesting about my insight is that I'm really born at like this intersection of business, psychology, and humanity. It doesn't focus on just one. My recommendations are not just business recommendations. They're going to be recommendations that are going to A, improve and enhance your people's lives, B, improve and enhance your business, and then C, you know, grow profit, grow your stability, your loyalty, your brand presence. Because, you know, at this point, I think Gen Zers that are up and coming, we're pretty specific on what companies we want to spend money with. We want companies that are, you know, good, solid, human-centric, people-centric companies that are doing good things and ethical things in the world. And so that's kind of where I'm coming in with the Radical Minds Consulting is, you know, leadership engagement, employee engagement. I do keynote speaking, some things like that. And then I have a visual branding and photography business where I work with small businesses and other local businesses in Atlanta. Could always work with, you know, other non-local people too. I have Rad Creative, which is where I do like media, copywriting, content creation, graphic design, things like that. And then, of course, the podcast. So I'm a little bit all over the place. I'm like a creative at heart. And
I love it.
Stay inspired as long as I get to, you know, just bask in all of my creative pursuits. I get really stagnant if I'm just bored.
No, I get that. I started a nonprofit and I'm actually just getting ready to get my certificate in life coaching. So
that is so exciting. I'm curious how that'll go for you. You'll have to, we'll have to stay in touch.
We're definitely going to talk. For sure. Awesome. Yes.
Well, I appreciate the shout out for the website too. So again, that was radicalvictoria.net. And I'm also on Facebook and TikTok. All of those are going to be linked on there too. So.
Okay, perfect. I'll make sure I put the links in the show notes. And I just want to say, I am so damn proud of you, and you, should be of yourself. And I just thank you so much for being here and sharing your story. This was very inspiring.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. And I'll, full disclosure, this is the first time I'm actually telling that story, like, publicly. So y'all heard it first here. Tiffany's got the deets.
I like it.
Cool. I could get into the weeds with it, but you know, I kept it pretty mild for this one. I'll have to come back.
No, you're good.
Do a deep dive into some of these situations. There's so much more that I didn't tell you, yeah. Tiffany. Gosh, I got stories for days.
Yes. No, I would love to. Oh my God. So do I. I think we all know somebody who can benefit from this episode. Please make sure to share it with them. And thank you guys so much for listening to my podcast. This really means a lot to me. If one of my episodes has helped you in any way, I would really like to know. It's important for me to know that the work that I'm doing is actually helping people. If you want more of me, make sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel and follow me on Instagram and TikTok. If you or anyone you know is in need of national hotlines, please go to truecrimeconnections.com. I have all the phone numbers there listed for anything that you could possibly imagine. All right, my renowned roots community, keep building hope and gaining strength. Until next time.